Tiger Nation. I am Byron Hulsey, headmaster at Woodbury Forest School, and I would like to welcome you to the Woodbury podcast series. This podcast consists of informal yet substantive conversations with alumni, faculty, staff, and students. The conversations explore how Woodbury's core values empowered alumni to build a solid foundation for their lives, how those core values are taught today by Woodbury teachers, and how those values are put into practice by today's students. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you enjoy. Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Woodbury podcast. We're fortunate today to be joined by John Gula, who is the executive director of the E.E. Ford Foundation. I've known John for a long while. Some years ago, when I was an assistant headmaster at Norfolk Academy, John was the very accomplished head of school at Blake in Minneapolis. And John was kind to welcome me to Minneapolis to visit Blake one fall. And I really enjoyed that trip. And then through my tenure as head of school at Randolph, John and I stayed closely connected. And for, I guess, John, you'll be able to tell us, but for maybe 12 or 13 years, you've been the executive director of the E.E. Ford Foundation. You've always been, to me, not only a personal friend, but also a real thought leader in the world of ideas, knowledge, and education. So welcome to the Woodbury podcast. John, thanks for being here.
Byron, thanks for the invitation. It's great to be with you, as always.
Well, you're kind to give us a little bit of your time. Let's start with you just kind of sharing with the audience a little bit about you, your bio, your history, your path to becoming the executive director of the E.E. Ford Foundation.
I grew up outside of Boston in Red Sox Nation and the son of two public school teachers in a family, an Italian-Irish family. So lots of aunts and uncles, every single one of whom was involved in public education in communities in and around Boston. I did not have the great good fortune or privilege to have gone to an independent school. Some ways regret that, but I had a reasonable public school education in Walpole, Mass. And then I think virtue of some athletic talent and not too embarrassing academic chops was admitted to Amherst College and thrived. I mean, I went there thinking medicine was my destiny, but the world of ideas, the life of the mind, the academy became this fascination for me. And while I didn't start there thinking I would go into the family business, I decided that I wanted to teach. I wanted to stay involved in learning. But I was impatient as a 22-year-old and had zero interest in becoming certified as a teacher. So the schools that would hire me were independent schools.
Right.
Now, I had did the year after I graduated from Amherst, I was a Green Dean, and in an interesting kind of full circle, did that year a little bit of what I do at the foundation. That is to say, I was one of those people, this was back in 1979-80, that traveled the country talking to high school sophomores, juniors about college. Now, I was the low person on the totem pole, so they assigned me to not to New York City or to Los Angeles, but to the less easily accessible spots in the country. So I traveled all over visiting schools. And then I began teaching. I taught at a place called St. Anne's. I taught math and physics. Physics and psychology were my areas of study, but I taught math and physics all the way from fourth grade through seniors, AP physics and AB calculus. Then at the impossible and irresponsible age of 25, the head of that school, after 3 years of being a full-time teacher, had me become the head of the middle school.
Oh, wow.
Became
at 25.
Age 25. I didn't know what I was doing, but I learned. And I didn't make too many horrible mistakes and kept the job. It was a big middle school, fourth grade through eighth grade, those ranges in an interesting school because St. Anne's is a no grades school with the ability for students as young as fourth grade to be in departmentalized courses. So it wasn't unusual for really strong math students, for example, to be in high school math classes,
wow,
music, et cetera. So, but anyway, I had that career there. And by that point, I knew I loved this. This was for me. Didn't want to be pegged just as a middle school guy. Got hired by a fellow named Michael Copo, who had just taken the job as head of school at Isidore Newman in New
Right.
Orleans. And so I went with him and a fellow named Robert Blair, three of us brand new Yankee administrators going to New Orleans, and was the upper school director there for a few years. That's where our first, my wife had, I'd met her at St. Anne's, also a fellow teacher. We moved to New Orleans, and what I said was a honeymoon that we spent there. Then our first son was born, and that was the pull to come back to family. My wife is from New York City, so I began to look and found a job at Riverdale Country School. We moved back to New York. I was upper school director at Riverdale, and then associate head, and then wanted to try headship. So, as you mentioned, I then entered those searches and felt really fortunate to have been offered the job as the head of school at Blake, a pre-K through 12th grade day school in Minneapolis, founded in 1900, three campuses at the time. And I was there for 14 years, and I truly loved the work. Now, keep in mind with the calendar, I didn't have to deal with what you and your fellow heads had to deal with in 2000, COVID. That came after I left. But my New Yorker wife wanted to come back to the city, her home, and had reminded me that the deal had ever been that would be in the upper Midwest forever. As much as I was loving that work, I didn't want to do the same thing again. I wanted to exercise different muscles. But I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and but I'd announced, because this is what the profession of heads requires, is that there was a long, almost 18-month advance time. And during that time, as I was thinking, I got a knock on the door from the Edward E. Ford Foundation. At the time, it was located in Portland, Maine. That's where Bob Hallett, who was the executive director, had the office located. And I said to them, "I'm sorry, it interests me, but we're not moving to Maine. I'm moving to New York. I can only take a job where I can get there by subway." And they said, "Oh, no, you can locate the office wherever you want." And I said, "Okay, now we're talking." And I pursued it and was offered the position. And that was 750 some odd schools ago. So this is the one of the great privileges I have now, is I feel I know the independent school world in a way that I thought I knew it after St. Anne's and Newman and Riverdale and Blake. I was wrong. Those four schools sit cheek by jowl in a tiny part of the NAS independent school spectrum. They're all pre-K through 12th grade, urban schools, highly selective, strong finances, non-sectarian, co-educational day schools. So they're different. They're, in my mind, they're quite different. But in the larger world of independent schools, they're in this tiny part of the spectrum. And now I have been to boarding, of course, day boarding, faith-based schools, progressive schools, traditional schools, military academies, experiential schools, et cetera, et cetera. So as I say, some 700, over 750 schools in 43 states. And it has been a real joy. The foundation has been around since the late 50s, and its mission is simply to support independent schools that have certain eligibility criteria, and we give away money.
To schools that are applying with a for a grant to do something specific, right?
Yes, so this almost 70-year-old family trust, really, a formal arrangement from back in the late 50s, for the majority of that time, made what we now call traditional grants. And in overly simplistic terms, an eligible school would come knocking on the foundation door. Eligibility would be determined. If the school was eligible, it would make a proposal. The board would decide to fund it or not. And then we would provide money for a school to pursue some project, in our words, often that they might not be able to undertake without our help. So that was until 20 years ago. That's what we did. And then at a point in the relatively recent past, the board decided to take some of our philanthropy and, for at least a portion of our calendar, concentrate more of it in larger grants to a smaller number of schools. That became what's now known as the Educational Leadership Grant. That differs both in size of the grants that we would make, but also because we have an expectation for a school pursuing an educational leadership grant that there'll be some benefit beyond the school itself, trying to catalyze work that might have reach beyond that individual institution that's receiving money from us.
So it's great as background. You've made clear that you have a unique range of exposure to the world of independent schools. Therefore, you're seeing more, absorbing more, learning more than most of us ever will in the world of independent school education. Tell us a little bit about the trends you're seeing, positive, negative, the things that give you energy and enthusiasm, the things that trouble you or worry you. I've know you well enough to have some sense of what you might mention, but let's just roll it out there and get it cover as much ground as we can here with the things that you're seeing out there that you think are worthy of more people understanding as we grapple with the promise and peril of the world we live in today.
There are people in our shared world that believe that these visits, which really are my favorite part of the job, I spend a full day, sometimes even more, at schools. And while there, I get to talk with students, just groups of students, and no other adults in the room. So one of the great treats is that I've been around adolescents my entire professional life. Put them at ease, they'll tell you the truth. They don't care if it's the foundation guy here on campus. They just will tell you what.
Unvarnished.
So, but I do that with students, with teachers, see classes, I attend assemblies, or in homerooms. I watch, if calendar permits, the arrival at the beginning of the day. And I've come to understand that this ineffable, not easily described, almost impossible to measure element of culture, the most important thing to understand a school, which is why those site visits are
Critical.
the absolute heart of an ability to try to help my board understand the school. But two trends. Heartening things are, and you'll know this because of our shared career in this world, but when I'm talking to faculty, I will often say to them, go around the room. I'll have half a dozen to 10 faculty. Introduce yourselves, but then tell me if you're early in your career, what drew you to the school? And if you're, been here for a decade or two or three or four, what keeps you at the school? Those on the more experienced end, you know the answer I hear every single time. Kids, the students. And that, I would say to you, is what fills my heart. There are people who are deeply committed to this work for all of the right reasons, because they establish relationships where they have a significant influence on these developing young people.
That's great.
And I think we all believe that next to one's family, and in the sort of modern era, less so, your church or synagogue or other community engagements, and one hopes much more so than popular culture, teachers can have that the greatest influence after family.
Massive.
Right. And so that to me is heartening. Now, the flip side of that, because you asked
John,
for.
I'll interrupt just for a second
Yeah,
and say I
sure.
think it's really important, and sometimes we mistake this, but it's really important for us all to remember that schools are for kids and they're not for us. And I think some of our travails occur when we make the mistake of believing that our schools are about our issues and our miseries and forget that. This is a precious, wonderful moment in a person's life that can be stewarded and cultivated by the very best teachers, coaches, advisors for the benefit of those we're privileged to serve.
100%. I agree. It's not in the end about, there are other constituent groups that are critical to the successful operation and happy world of a given independent school. The faculty's second after the students, parents who entrust their children to the care of an institution, the alumni who support it with their generosity and involvement, the board who hold the future of the school in trust. All of those constituent groups critically important. But you're absolutely right to put in the central and elevated position. It is about students. And
Yeah.
decisions about a school need to be made, it seems to me, with that first consideration of, is this good for the kids we serve? But the flip side of that is that I fear that the ability to attract and retain superb teachers is more difficult in 2025 than it was when I started as a school head in 1998, or when I started independent schools in 1980. It just, for a number of reasons, I think we as a society don't reflect to young people who might be thinking about careers the many reasons they could and should consider. And it's
Yeah.
not, I don't mean solely pecuniary. I don't think that culture, there are other cultures in France, in Japan, where those who choose to teach in much of Scandinavia,
More
which
elevated.
exactly. But it is so an example that I sometimes give, because I stay in touch, I care about trying to mentor former students or others who go into teaching. And as a teacher, you convene with your reunion class at the 5 year or 10 year mark after your undergraduate, and then people will say, "Are you still a teacher?" I
Yeah.
don't think they say, "Are you still a banker? Are you still a lawyer? Are you
Yeah.
still an operating room physician?"
Yeah.
No,
No,
but
right.
as if it were some holding pattern,
Yeah.
and it almost is that kind of laugh line for some who are in the profession. But it takes, I think, enlightened parents who may have invested a
Yeah.
lot in their own children. For if their children decide they want to go into teaching, lots of young people who will say, "This my parents are a little disappointed. They
I
they've
understand. Yeah. I totally get where you're coming from. And that is a major threat to our future sustainability as generators of knowledge and appreciation of acquired culture and the best that's been learned and thought and written and produced in time. I agree with you completely. That's a big challenge. I know you well, and I know of your general take on the purpose of a liberal arts education. I'd love to hear you share that with our listeners, and then if you would maybe talk about your sense of the moral purpose of what we do and how that can be tainted by, to be specific, your sense of merit scholarships and the way we've kind of bastardized, if you will, financial aid as an industry.
really, this continuation that happens in the healthiest of families of trying to raise young people to be happy, responsible, autonomous
Yeah.
human beings who have a sense of what they find to be worthwhile, beautiful, compelling in their own lives. I mean, early on in my career, I was much more interested in more social engineering. I gave that up early on. We shared this just last week, pointing out to your audience that we communicate with some frequency beyond podcasts. But I shared with you that definition in that article that we both enjoyed, the definition of education as a non-coercive rearrangement of desires.
Yeah,
There's
that's great.
no one right definition, but I love that. But every word in that is meaningful. The non-coercive, it's a choice. I say this in a non-sectarian way, but there's something incredibly sacred about a good education because it's chosen. You can't really force an education. You can train in some ways with all kinds of external rewards or punishments. But to truly have an educated human being, that's going to be that non-coercive. And then the rearrangement is confronting them with ideas they may not have had. I had a head explosion when the whole notion of trigger warnings first became popular. And I want to be careful. I'm not opposed to the kind of relationships that allow a teacher to anticipate certain sensitivities of the students that they know well. But there was something in the practice of trigger warnings that bothered me, because I'd always felt as a teacher, and I tried throughout my career, even when an administrator, to always teach, because that was the purest, 40 minutes or 50
Yeah,
minutes of my day.
I agree.
But when I was doing that, part of my job was to untether them from the assumptions that they brought to the class.
Yeah.
And sometimes that would create some conflict of peace in their being, because all of a sudden the assumptions were maybe not reliable guides. Anyway, the purpose, it seems to me, is not pre-professional training. I mean, it is preparation for a life. And yes, some skills to allow you as a young person to make free choice in some of those earlier mentioned professions where they don't say, are you still? So law schools will train you in the law, and medical schools will train you in medicine, and business schools can train you in business. You can learn some of those practical skills, but to learn, as you had said, the best that has been written and said, because we both know who came up with that saying. But that's the goal. And then the second part you also allude to, which is character. And I think, again, that this parallel between the level of influence of one's parents and family, but then a secondary influence is what you learn in this formative time. Certainly for Woodbury, but for all schools, especially perhaps some pre-K through 12th grade schools, you have these kids for 14 years in those schools for them to learn a set of values, and then to help them choose to want to honor those values. A quick example, you and I could both give hundreds of these, but what do you do when there's a rule about participating in an athletic contest requiring you to be in school all day, and somebody is absent from school, but then they show up for the game and they're a key player and it's an important contest, and you say sorry, and then you have, because the tough questions aren't easily answered. Oh, you were going to punish the other students on that team by denying them the teammate? Yes, I am. There's a lesson here.
I feel strongly about this, as you would imagine. Your values ought to cost you something. If your values are just conveniences, those aren't values. Our rhetoric about values is often not matched with the reality of our actions. But our values ought to be, it ought to cost us something.
Agreed. And I worry some about a number of not to be named independent schools where I think that culture that I referenced earlier becomes much more transactional. And this is not unrelated to escalating tuition costs that have far outstripped inflation. So we ask and we deliver great, I think, great value. But when families who, and this will be my clever little segue to the
Segue. Yeah,
with
well
you.
done.
But in that world, there is this expectation. No, for this tuition, what do you mean my child's not going to play number one doubles tennis, or be Romeo in the Romeo and Juliet play, or whatever it may be? For I have these expectations. That's why I'm paying the tuition. Or consequently, for the admission to college, I paid so they could get in to this college you're telling me they now weren't admitted to. Why didn't you do your job? Those sorts of things are sources of enormous frustration. One of the great things, in addition to the 70 years of E.E. Forward Foundation, but as a result of this last dozen years at the foundation, I've become a more active historian of independent schools. One of the trends, if you trace independent schools, which you and I both know preceded any public schools. So the first schools in this nation of ours were long before we were a nation, but they were private, meaning they were privately funded. But over the, you take those schools, and we have a dozen or so that were founded before 1800, but take them all the way through to the current 2025, one of the things that they reflect is greater and greater access. Many of the schools, just boys, just white boys, just rich white boys. Then there were schools for girls, and then the schools began to become more religiously first, then racially, and then in other forms of identity. But along the line, there's also this through line. There were some schools, even early in the 20th century, who made commitments. One of the founders at Blake said the school was to be for the worthy, not just the wealthy, quote unquote.
That's beautiful.
And there were, you know, some of them too. We won't elaborate all the listing of schools, but as part of their founding documents were to create ministers or teachers or others, and then they were often coming from less economically sounder families. They were often poor children. So, but this trend line is a point of pride, and yet it's a complicated one because, forgive me a little bit of a segue to, but to explain this, I find often that I need to help people understand that they're indulging in the danger of a single story about independent schools. That word, that danger of a single story, is the title of a really famous TED Talk by Adichie, the Nigerian author. And I just want to give her credit because I've appropriated that title. The danger of a single story for independent schools is that they're just bastions of privilege. They
That's right.
are often bastions of privilege, but that's not all they are. They are also schools committed, deeply committed, to the extent their resources allow, to have access to those whose families couldn't begin to afford those aforementioned eye-popping tuitions. And it is a central commitment of a number of schools to do that by intention, because it makes it not in some antiquated sense of noblesse oblige, but instead, because that is the community you want learning from each other together at school.
That's right. And so keep pulling on that thread as it relates to the trend toward discounting and merit scholarships.
First of all, there's no uniform agreement about, what is need,
That's
because
right.
need is subjective to a particular school and its cost and its location, etc. But I do believe there's something really important and honorable about a school that will use its resources, whatever they may be, to provide financial aid, financial assistance to meet demonstrated need. And I would want to clarify that that has to go to the cost of attendance, not just tuition. A school makes a mistake if it only focuses on the tuition charged and not what does it cost you to be a full participant
That's
in the
right.
experience that a school offers. Now, this is really hard stuff because many schools, particularly in an increasingly global world, want to promote, international trips. Those are expensive items on a financial aid budget. But I still think a good school has to think about that, and there are lower fruit to pluck. It ensures that, the cost for prom or to go, there's a English trip going to go to see a production of a play that they're reading, but they're going to charge a la
Yeah.
carte rather than part of the tuition. So all of those kinds of things. But you are getting to the point that you and I have discussed in, and I won't name any schools, but I will name the urban markets. There are areas where there's an abundance of really fine independent schools. And perhaps as a result of a complicated shifting of phenomena, both the cost of schools, maybe other alternatives, but there seem to be an insufficient number of families willing or able to pay that full sticker price.
Premium.
Schools are cling tenaciously to the good work that they do. And as an enrollment marketing tool, schools are discounting their tuition, not because there is need, but because they really want the student to apply.
Yeah.
Let me give you just one example. A school is not full, and somebody moves to town in July,
Yep.
and they knock on the door of the school, and they want to apply, and they do apply, and their kids are terrific. And the family says, well, is financial aid available? And they say, well, you have to apply for that, which they do in an expedited way. And then the school says, well, you don't qualify for that financial aid. Now, what if that results in the family saying, well, we're not going to then come? And the school is under enrolled.
Yeah.
It's hungry for additional revenue, and there's
Sure.
no marginal increased cost for the
Right.
school to take those kids in, especially not if they're sophomores or juniors. There's more of an opportunity cost if they're pre-K and a school believes it can
Understood.
fill those
Yeah.
spots later on. But that is happening. But now it's beginning to happen in a head-to-head competition, where, and I kid you not, that parents, they're clever. They go to a school. What will you do for me?
Yeah, they're shopping.
School X is going to do this.
Yeah, John, I was visiting with a person from another school not too long ago about this matter, and he said that at their school that they don't have a merit aid program, but they match. And I thought, well, that's honest, and it's straightforward. But what it does is just encourage the transactional behavior of parents who are shopping and making deals with the various schools that are on offer.
For us in the secondary elementary independent school world, you want a pretty loudly singing canary in the coal mine, or about to drop off of the perch in the coal mine. Look
Yeah.
at higher ed. Look at some of Ron Lieber's work in the New York Times. The higher ed has developed incredibly complex predictive algorithms, scraping information on a given family that is available publicly so as to tailor the offer to maximize revenue for the school.
Yeah. Don't these practices, which are predictable and understandable on many, many levels, don't those practices erode what you were saying earlier about the purpose of a liberal arts education?
Yes.
And that's my biggest anxiety and my biggest burn here, because it seems to me that higher ed is suffering from a significant loss of social trust nationally. To my way of thinking, an element of that loss of social trust is this very act of discounting and playing with the numbers and treating people as if they are, commodities, and fooling around with the sticker price and the discount rate, and families thinking that they're getting, they're not getting good deals because they didn't get what Johnny got on the side over here. And then that just irritates folks and makes them feel like they've been manipulated. That erodes social trust. And other higher ed's got many, many other issues, but that financial manipulation is one, I believe.
I agree with you. I mean, it exists sort of in various strata of higher ed, depending upon the resources. There are some not to be named higher ed institutions that could afford to reduce their tuition, not increase it
Yeah, of
annually.
course. Yeah.
They don't do that because the argument goes that would leave money on the table, and decrease their ultimate ability to do what they want. But this is an art, not a science. So that makes it complicated. I'll give you one example that you might remember from your days, both at Norfolk and Randolph, as well as I don't think it's a practice at Woodbury, and I don't know if there was a practice there, but it's evolved as a practice in independent schools about calculating need. There have always been disagreements, always been specific choices that a school will make. Does a school, for example, does a given independent school take into account a family that perhaps earlier in its life had been irresponsible with regard to health insurance? And then they had a crisis. And then, of course, they did whatever they needed to care for a member of the family, and they incurred enormous medical debt. Does the school take that into account in analyzing the family's finances? Some did, some did not. So there can be nuance and disagreements. What about a family? Two parents, no children at home. Do both parents work?
Yeah, that's a big one.
And if one doesn't, do you then impute an income, a reasonable income, for the non-working parent and put that onto the side of the ledger that says you could have this as additional revenue and you're choosing not to?
There's that, and a very real one now is like, what are you going to do about the value of the home? Even if the value of your home has increased significantly in the last number of years, that's only worth something if you sell. No legitimate, in my mind, way of doing business would say that you've got to sell your home to come to school here.
Yeah, and you don't even have to sell. You could remortgage it and access cash, but I wouldn't even advocate that.
Yeah,
I mean,
no.
I agree with you about that. The easier questions that I'm sure you've dealt with, I remember when I was a head, I dealt with, were people when we did the analysis and said that they had these assets, and they said, no, we're saving those for college. So wait a second, we're going to subsidize University X, College Y? No.
That's always the case, isn't it?
What makes this hard, and I've had these heart-to-heart conversations with school heads, and they said, but I don't want to have to fire employees.
Yeah, I get it.
I have to balance the budget. I have a hard-nosed finance committee and a good board, but they're saying, you can't, you have to live within your means. And so here's this money that would allow me to keep the ceramics teacher or whatever it might be.
One of my more recent exposures to the E. Ford Foundation was the work that John Austin, the head of school at Deerfield, led with this framework. I was just part of the task force that assisted with that. This framework for discourse and academic discourse and the way we in schools, ideally, if we can, work with challenging environments beyond the hallowed kind of grounds of our schools. How do we manage those? The framework aspires to give some structure around best practice along those lines. Today, you posted on LinkedIn a dilemma. What is that dilemma and how does it apply to the framework?
Well, first, let me just thank you, Byron, for your willingness to join with John Austin and Lee Levison and seven other school heads from your incredible, amazing, impressive school and their schools to try to provide a tool for independent schools to have civil discourse in a moment in our nation's time where I think we are dangerously factionalized and don't have the ability to talk across differences and find people can disagree, but they don't have to be disagreeable
Right.
and can try to find some kind of common ground. But so my posting is the following. Using news of the day, I said, just imagine that in a homeroom or an advisory group, a student who had been consuming the news of the day said, I'm struggling to understand two recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions. One to say that it is going to be impermissible for an institution of higher education to ask about an applicant's racial identity. But the same court finds that the use of visual assumptions about racial identity are a justifiable means for detaining and questioning someone on the streets of LA. And I'm posing it as this not entirely, I'm sure, hypothetical. What does the teacher in that homeroom or that advisory group do? And my concern is that there's only one responsible thing to do, which is to engage that student and her or his for their fellow classmates in a discussion about this, but many faculty love their jobs and they're afraid. How do I manage that? That if we don't figure that out, we are irresponsible in the fulfillment of our duties as educators. We have to you the teacher, and this is what the frame, you know it because you were involved in it. Framework doesn't tell you
No.
what to think. It tries to give a means by which an educational community could establish expectations on how such difficult and potentially volatile questions can nonetheless be examined in the community
Right.
of the academy.
And too often, as you suggest, teachers will just pass on that or default to mentioning the Bears Vikings game last night or whatever the most recent contest was. And perhaps because they're anxious about the effects of trying to wade into these contested waters. And the framework is designed to support schools being a little bit more courageous without taking a partisan stand.
Kudos to you and your fellow members of the advisory committee, and then to John and Lee, because you all helped with, language is
Yeah.
critically important. And one of the improvements in that framework from its initial draft was the use of disciplined nonpartisanship and a casting off of neutrality that individual teachers will have strong opinions. It doesn't mean they are obligated. In fact, in some ways, the argument goes against a declaration of where you may stand. But your job is to allow an exploration of that among young people who are trying to wrestle with how shall I think about this question?
Yeah, that's right. That gets to the non-coercive rearrangement of what was the last words
Right.
there?
A non-coercive rearrangement of desires.
Of desires,
Yeah,
yeah.
that's a little bit too hedonistic, I think, or adjusted. I don't know. But it was sort of values would work,
Yeah,
is it?
values, yeah. John, we're out of time. I would love if you're willing to do this again because I feel like we just scratched the surface. And one topic that we didn't touch on that is really
AI.
on the mind for me is AI.
Yeah. All right.
And if you're willing, maybe a little further down the line here, we can re-engage and have chapter two.
It would be a pleasure for me to do so. I urge you to wait until some of your listeners have some reaction. They may say, "Stay away from that Gula guy. Like, I don't want to listen to him again."
Yeah,
But
well,
we'd like to.
I'm confident that you will appeal to many in the Tiger Nation. So
Thank
thanks
you.
to John Gula for being on the Woodbury podcast. Look forward to a future conversation about the world of independent schools. And John, thanks so much and go Tigers.
Thanks, Baron. It's been a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Woodbury Podcast. We hope you found our discussion insightful and engaging. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please consider subscribing, rating, or leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. Stay tuned for more conversations in the future. And remember, the conversation doesn't have to end here. Connect with us on Woodbury Forest School social media, reach out with your questions or comments, and let's keep the dialogue going. Until next time, take care and go Tigers!